enough to beat me anymore. I know the shape of his mind, language he eats. He's got him weak in the knees now. He ain't strong enough to teach me anymore. And when he dies, I'll be waiting for the happiest, sad day of my life. I won't cry or memorialize it. We will never separate. Step, the sound of his keys. He ain't strong anymore. I've seen him battle with time and jokes that he hides behind his wheels. He ain't long enough to reach me. Of his smile, rate of his heart. I know his every plan, the mood where they'll end, the spot where they'll start. He ain't anymore. And when he dies, sad day of my life, I won't cry or memorialize it. We will never separate. We will never separate. We will never separate. Oh,
all ice water is tears and tears and tears and tears. She treats me far too frosty. This hanging on has cost me. Listen to what I was too soft hearted. If you made the dust cap, I'd done it. People will always be tempted to wipe their feet on anything with what's written on it. I'm an evil winter, but I'm freezing, freezing. This sort of feeling is amazing.
Oh, I hate to talk over XTC, but I got to make room for Benjamin and Too Much Information. This, of course, XTC from English Settlement, Snowman. Paul Schneider preceded that with Man off of his Escape Velocity album. Robin Guthrie did Search Among the Flowers. The Horses Ha did Tea Creek in the Dunes. Dennis Dyken with Bell Sound gave us Temptation Cake, and Zoe Van Gogh, We All Hid in Basements, which is what we all did at the end of 1999 when the threat of computer meltdown happened. Who knows what's going to happen at stroke of midnight this time, but hopefully something good. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, on the web at WFMU.org. Happy New Year. I'm Irene Trudell. See you next week.
to eliminate really suddenly in the afternoon. It was about 10 hours after I had taken the capsule. It was an unusual elimination. Like, when I say unusual, it was, like, really fine, as if there was a lot of little tiny, tiny, tiny eggs or little tiny, tiny worms. I couldn't tell which. But the next day, my son took one capsule, and he passed parasites that night as well. But with me, that night, like the second day that I took it, I passed parasites that were, about as long as the width of a quarter. And they were like a triangular shape, and they had little feelers on them. I got brave and fished out four of them out of the toilet. Even that very first day, I said to my son, "You know something? I feel good. I can't explain it. I just feel good." And the next day, when these other things came out, I felt all of a sudden, and I have to say all of a sudden, it wasn't like instantaneously, but just compared to the time before I went to the bathroom and after the bathroom, I felt invigorated. And that's the only way I can explain it.
2009 starts off perfect. I'm swaying back and forth in a kitchen in Madrid, pretending that I know the words to the New Year's carol that everyone is singing. But since I can't speak Spanish, I'm obviously just miming nonsense. No one seems to mind except Grandma, who keeps looking over at me and flashing these cold, steely eyes. This only makes me more self-conscious about the fact that I'm an American, male, and a lot older than my Korean companion, who all these Spanish women in the apartment are doting over. And so I clutch the black Bakelite telephone that used to belong to Generalissimo Franco even closer to my chest, and I try to put as much feeling as I can muster into the silent words I'm making up with my mouth. 2008 totally sucked. I had pretty much failed at everything. I'd failed at making people at my job like me. I'd failed at cleaning my apartment. I failed at going to the gym for more than a half hour a month. I failed at reading the science fiction novels I wanted to read. I failed at vegetarianism. I failed at saving money. I failed at keeping in touch with old friends. I failed at learning foreign languages. I failed at posting to my internet group on a regular basis. I failed at moderate drinking. And I had totally failed at love. Which is why I'm in Madrid. I'd spent a good part of 2008 palling around with Jun Lee, a Korean girl whom I'd met at Barnes & Noble in Union Square, where she was spending her afternoon studying Spanish. She was in New York for an acting workshop. Her dream was to act in Spanish movies. Jun Lee was extremely resourceful, and when her workshop ended in the fall, she pulled off a move to Valencia to continue her studies. When she left, I acted like it was no big deal. In fact, I started carrying on with her best friend a few weeks later. which of course she found out about. I got an email that was completely composed of sad face animated emoticons. Actually, it was quite ingenious. The tears from the emoticons on the top row would collect at the bottom of the screen, eventually drowning all the emoticons, and when the last one took its final gasp, the screen would flash something in Korean that said in effect, "You have suffocated me with sorrow." Since I had nothing to do for Christmas, I decided I could make it up to Jun Lee by meeting her in Madrid for a week of museums, restaurants, and architecturally themed walking tours. This was our last night together. On New Year's Day, she was going back to Valencia, and I was flying home to New York. Franco's telephone and the apartment we were celebrating in both belonged to Carlos, who is the chief cybersecurity officer for the King of Spain. And that's how he's amassed this amazing museum of fascist telecom in his living room. And even though we can only communicate in broken English, he is moved by my genuine appreciation for Franco's cordless bathroom phone. I scream like a child when he shows me the secret panel on the back, and he slaps me on the shoulder. "I'm glad you like Americano. I'm glad you like." Now that Obama has won the election, Americans are okay again. Every single person I speak to at the party tells me how happy they are about Obama. In fact, when Grandma finds out that I'm going to the inauguration, her eyes melt and she kisses me like 20 times. But Jun Lee is the real hit of the party. There's just something about this flushed-faced kid sputtering in Spanish that just makes everybody swoon. In fact, this is how we ended up at the party in the first place. Earlier in the day, we were at a bar eating tapas, and every time Jun Lee would order something, everyone in the bar would fall silent to listen to her accent. Eventually, the couple next to us, sitting at the bar, started up a conversation with Jun Lee in Spanish. I just smiled and nodded. The only word I can say with full confidence is tinto. When the couple, Juan and Carolina, found out that we had no New Year's plans, Madrid hospitality demanded we accompany them to their house for New Year's Eve supper. And after an amazing meal, we accompanied them to their friend Carlos's party. We made it just in time to participate in the strange ritual of stuffing your mouth full of grapes during the countdown to the new year. And I'm determined to do it right, not because I'm excited about 2009, but because I am so damn happy to see 2008 go away. Carlos is the center of a big family and a big circle of friends. Everyone is warm and welcoming. But like I said, Jun Lee is the real hit of the party. The women are both filled with awe and horror as she downs every drink handed to her, wine, tequila, gin, beer, and eventually they send Carlos's wife Isabella over to interrogate me. Isabella works for the UN International Court. She prosecutes war criminals. "So," she asks me, "what is the nature of your relationship with Jun Lee? Are you together?" "Yes," I reply. "She is a lot younger than you, no?" "Not really," I lie. "I'm actually a lot younger than I look, you know. Alcoholism can make you look a lot older." Note to war criminals, this actually makes her laugh. The party goes all night long. Even the little children are allowed to stay up till dawn. And I decide that 2009 is going to be the year I turn it all around. I make a bunch of vows with my new friends. I tell Carlo that I'm finally going to make my documentary about the year 1984. I promise Isabella that I'm done with the 23-year-olds for once and for all. I promise Juan that I'll learn at least one foreign language, maybe even two this year. And I promise Grandma that I'll start paying more attention to the world around me, even the things I hate. And as we all walk to the recycling bins at 5 in the morning with the bottles, cans, and cardboard packages nicely separated and tied up with twine, I promise Carolina that I will stop recycling like an American. And afterwards, as I carry a passed out Jun Lee up the stairs to our hotel room so we can pack for the airport, I promise her that this year I will listen to my heart.
My name is Dan Sinker. I am a faculty member in the journalism department at Columbia College Chicago. I run a mobile storytelling site called sellstories.net, and I also blog about media for the Huffington Post. The most popular post that I wrote this year was a post called "This Song Ain't About You, The Media Misses the Real Message of the Stuart Kramer Interview." It ran on the Huffington Post on April 13th. Of 2009. It was written kind of the day after Jon Stewart interviewed Jim Cramer on The Daily Show, and that isn't normally something that I would write about because, you know, kind of writing about what happens on TV is kind of boring to me. But I woke up that morning and it was suddenly on the front page of every news site that I visited, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, you know, even actually the Huffington Post itself. And the thing that that just really kind of drove me crazy, because suddenly we have these news organizations running as front page news the fact that the host of a comedy news program interviewed another kind of comedy business weird whatever it is that he does guy, and running that as news when what really was interesting about that interview was here was for the first time kind of somebody in the media kind of really questioning the media's role in the lead up to the financial meltdown that began in 2008 and that we've been, you know, kind of suffering with ever since. In that interview, Jim Cramer kind of begins to defend himself, and Stewart almost offhandedly says, you know, this song ain't about you. And I kind of took that as a launching point to talk about what really kind of the meta discussion that was really having, which was the fact that our traditional news sources have stopped really trying to be news sources, and the best that they can muster now is to write breathlessly about a comedian interviewing someone on TV, when what they really should have done was dig into what are now becoming quite clear financial issues that were, you know, sticking up like red flags for years. And so I went on to just say, you know, this is the issue with media right now. When newspapers worry about, you know, oh, journalism is dying and stuff like that, you know, the real question is, well, who killed it? You know, was it really the fault of the internet, or was it the fault of just suddenly every mainstream traditional media source deciding, you know what, let's just talk about fluff, you know? And you see that still to this day, you know, you see how much more coverage there was of Tiger Woods than there was about Obama deciding to, you know, re-up on the war in Afghanistan. It's it's a disaster. The Post became really popular. In fact, it's kind of funny because the Huffington Post, it's a bit of a black box when you write for them. You don't really see many statistics about who's reading you and how popular it is. You can kind of gauge it on whether it shows up on the front page, and certainly you can gauge it based on comments. And within half an hour of posting it, it was on the front page, and the comment count began to just kind of increase and increase and increase on it. But when I really realized that this was much larger than a normal post was that morning. I was actually here at the college working an orientation, and I get a kind of an emergency email from the photo host, the free photo hosting that I was using to put all these screenshots that are in the actual story. Those weren't hosted on the Huffington Post servers. Those were hosted on this free photo hosting, which gives you this incredible, like 10 gigabytes of bandwidth. I mean, just something ridiculous, something that in a month you're never going to exceed. And this was on the 13th, so this was the middle of the month, and I get this kind of, you know, all caps email, you've exceeded your bandwidth for hosting on this site because there have been so many server calls pulling these images in. And so I actually then had to send, and this was a Saturday morning, I had to send a panicked email to the editor that I work with at Huffington and say, hey, can you pull these down and actually host them on your own site? And it continued throughout the weekend. It was the lead story, and by the end of it, I think there were 490 comments on the story, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's not a huge story, but it does take a different tactic to it. It wasn't just more breathless reporting about how awesome it was that Jon Stewart, you know, kind of socked Jim Cramer in the mouth, but instead was talking about the larger issue of how it can be that we have a media that's become so toothless that this is a lead story for them.
I'm Vanessa Bertozzi, and I work for Etsy.com. And Etsy is an online marketplace for artists and designers and vintage sellers where they can sell their stuff. So it's all handmade and vintage items. I kind of think of Etsy as like the raw source for creativity. You know, it's all independent artists and vintage collectors. So you could think of it as almost like this raw source of, you know, what creative people are into. And when it comes to most popular, I've got one word for you, owls. Owls on Etsy, it's definitely a phenomenon. It's something that we noticed pretty early on. Etsy's been around since June 2005. And then I started late 2006, early 2007. And already at that point, owls were kind of in full effect. The homepage of our site is partly curated by people who work for Etsy, but also curated by the community of people who use the site, and which at this point is like millions of people, right? And like the whole point about Etsy is there's millions and millions of items, you know, and like there's about 200,000 active sellers, and everybody's making handmade stuff or vintage stuff, so the whole point is that it's all unique and there's like this incredible diversity. But over and over again, we kept seeing owls. And if owls are on the front page, they're going to sell. If owls are featured in our gift guides or on our blog, like it gets more views than anything. It gets more like attention than anything else. And it even came down to us doing a vote for the most Etsy animal, like Etsy's spirit animal. And of course, owls like blew everything else away. You know, I kind of thought that maybe the jackalope would have a chance, but no, the owls just dominate. And it's now, you know, going to be 2010, and they're still going strong. And I'm not sure, you know, the roots of the owl. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I think it's because this is my own pet theory. But I think it's because they're like the perfect combination of kind of cute, but also kind of weird. I think they're also like the shape of an owl is kind of like, it can be very stylized and it sort of like has simple shapes. So it's pretty like quick and easy to make things in the shape of an owl. Nobody's actually written in to say, this is why I love owls or this is why I think owls are so popular on Etsy. But we talk about it a lot at the office here. I think it's just because, you know, Etsy's part of this larger handmade movement of people who are learning how to make things and trying to, you know, express themselves and get their work out there. And I think that the owl, I think it's become sort of like this unofficial mascot. It's good to have a mascot, you know, it's good to have something that we can all point to and say like, oh, that's what we're about. And we're about owls, even though I don't know why. And I'm on the bus, and the bus is pretty crowded, and there's this crazy woman on it. And she's screaming, I'm going to rape you! I'm going to rape you! She was obviously, like, cracked out of her mind. And we're all, like, kind of looking at each other, being totally silent. And, you know, we're both, like, you know, really worried for her and kind of scared, but also resisting the urge to completely crack up. We're just looking at each other, just kind of, it was this weird mix of emotions about this woman. And also it was weird because she was like 83 pounds and there's no way that she could possibly rape any of us. And so finally she like gets off the bus at like 6th Street and then the whole bus like kind of livens up and it gives us a reason to kind of talk to one another. So I turn to the guy next to me and I'm like, you know, gosh, I hate it when my mom gets on the same bus as me. And he laughs. And that's how I got invited to the Facebook Christmas party. He's this like super nerdy, shy programmer. And we're, like, talking on the rest of the bus. I tell him my name, and it's a distinctive name. And he's Persian. And so I didn't know. I always thought Persian was, like, a slur or, like, out of date. Maybe it was a colonial word. I didn't know that you were allowed to use it. But he says he's Persian, and I found out that Iranians always say they're Persian. So we laugh. And then I get off the bus, and, like, an hour later, he Facebook friends me. And I say, oh, sure, yeah, that's the guy I met on the bus. And I add him, and that's all I think, you know, all I think about it. And we never talk, nothing. 2 months later, he sends me a private message on Facebook. He's like, I was wondering if you'd go with me to the holiday party. So I just wrote back, I'm like, totally, I'll go with you. This sounds awesome. I think he just, like, took the opportunity because he knows there was no other way I would ever go out with him. So, like, 3 days before, he sends me another private message and tells me about the details of the party. And it's called, the official title is Black Christmas Fantastique, and it's sort of a combination of high luxury and circus, which I think is kind of interesting because circus is usually, you know, pretty gross. And it's creative formal, and I don't know if you guys know anything about San Francisco, but we take costumes like super seriously. So I get really, really excited, and I go and put together this kind of fancy ringleader costume. So I have on like black sequin shorts and like hot pants and a red brocade jacket and a little top hat and a bullwhip and stuff and like super tall boots, et cetera, et cetera, and this huge white poinsettia pin on my collar, you know, to make it festive and, you know, holiday-ish. So we decided to meet at this bar first, and he's really shy and super nervous because he's probably never gone out really with someone like me, and here I am sitting across from him, and he's probably just been weird. He's probably been just like stalking my posts.
Didn't you actually worry about this? Didn't you think that this is the guy who might actually be watching your every move on Facebook?
I don't care. I love getting stalked. Like, really, I do. As long as it's light stalking, as long as they're not stalking me while I'm, by looking into my bathroom or stalking me with their junk in their hand, I don't know. I have no privacy issues whatsoever. In fact, I was flattered, which is kind of weird. This is kind of the reason why I would tell you all this. So we met at the bar first, and he's super nervous, and but he orders two rum and cokes, which is hilarious. Of course he would order a rum and coke. And he loosens up a bit, and he's like, oh, there's someone I really want you to meet tonight.
I'm like, yeah, but there's a lot of people you want me to meet tonight, but whatever. So we get in a cab and go to the venue. And we get out of the cab, and immediately, even outside, it's insane. It's like the year 2000 again, back in like the dot-com boom back here in San Francisco. There were launch parties for dot-com companies every week, and there was free open bar, free food. But this is like that times 30. Even outside, there were huge shapes, these inflatable shapes that they had made just for the party. I mean, I can't imagine why they would have them otherwise. And there's one of, like, the profile of a person, and they're all lit from within. They're about, you know, maybe 10 feet tall. And there's one of the Facebook icon that's lit from within that's blue, so it just looks like the big Facebook F. And so I haven't even walked in. I'm already seeing, like, 20 grand in custom-made party gear. I'm like, awesome! So we walk in and check in, and he just shows his badge and kind of, like, motions toward me. He's still, like, completely awkward. We walk in, and there's already people in, like, all kinds of performers walking around in glow wire and people on stilts, and it's insane. And the venue is called the Galleria at the San Francisco Design Center, and it's the six-story tall atrium with an open catwalk all along. And we were handed a program as we got in that I actually still have in front of me. Do you want to hear what was on the program of the venue?
Of course.
It says, Black Christmas Fantastique. Take your imagination to another realm and get twisted under the big top. Sip a cocktail under the tent and nosh on culinary delight. That's on the first floor. And it says, travel up. Float to the Cirque of Dreams on the second floor. Come flirt at the Teatro Cochetto on the third floor. Test your luck at Le Cirque Bonchamp, House of Cards and Casino, on the fourth floor. And then it says the main event Mastercraft, 10:30 to midnight. See and hear from all floors. Enjoy the aerial shows, costumed entertainers, and sideshows throughout the evening. And they have the menu on the back. Hand-rolled sushi, twisted biscuits, Sammy's and sliders, mini sandwich stations, livestock pen. There were actual real live livestock because it was a circus theme, which kind of messed up. They had pig racing. Do you know what pig racing is?
I have never heard of pig racing.
It's piglet racing. It's the cutest thing ever. They take tiny little piglets and have them, they put them, you know, in little sparkly outfits. And there's a track, and they follow an Oreo cookie around the track. I've usually seen it at actual, like, state fairs and stuff, but they had that inside the venue. But the track was smaller, but they had pig racing inside the venue. It was the cutest thing, and people were betting on it.
I actually used to own a potbelly pig named Fido when I was 19.
But
But I only had him for a few months because the meth addict who also lived in the building had a pair of pit bulls who ate him.
Oh, no. Wait, so I forgot to tell you about the most important thing about this party. You walk in, the first thing you notice are these, they had about eight of them, enormous LED screens. And I've never seen screens this big in my entire life. And they look exactly like the Facebook interface, only it's white on black. So it's kind of like the black Amex card of Facebook pages. And what they did is they set up a Facebook site just for the party. And they even made it, like, my date was telling me, yeah, they made there's a iPhone app that he had on his phone. I went and downloaded it. You had to have a special code. So you could actually upload stuff from the party to these huge screens. But it wasn't tied at all to your Facebook account. So that was really weird because people were just, like, starting all these random accounts and, like, kind of going crazy. You could have a drink total. So it could see, like, you know, whatever your, you know, fake profile was and how many drinks you had. Because every time you went to go get a drink at the bar, the bartenders would scan your wristband and, you know, be recorded on this magnetic strip. Turns out that all the liquor companies gave Facebook the liquor for free because they would then Facebook gave them the data on what time people were drinking what liquors and like getting a whole like range so like they would just know what we want to drink and stuff.
So the party was basically a front for surveillance research.
Pretty much, but it kind of got out of control because there was a leaderboard. I mean, I don't know who thought up this because it was such a stupid idea. you know, all these, like, kind of big nerds that had never really, you know, got their partying days out in college because they were too busy, you know, drinking Mountain Dew and programming, you know, getting wasted and watching their numbers go up on the leaderboard. And I didn't have the heart to tell them that, you know, all you have to do is order these drinks. You don't actually have to drink them, but, you know, they were getting out of control. But there's also these photo booths that you could go in and take your picture, and then, you know, it would immediately go up on these big screens. And there are also kiosks where you could go, if you didn't have the iPhone app, you could go and, like, post and comment on all the different things, you know, going on the big screens, and there are also smaller screens throughout. It's really weird because, like, half of the people were kind of gathered around the various bars that were set up, and then the rest of them were, you know, then everybody was huddled around these screens. It was like, you can't even get away from screens, even at Christmas. Oh my God, someone put up a quiz. So they went around at the party, took pictures of all the different, of all what they thought were the ugliest bartenders, put up a quiz on who is the ugliest bartender at the party. And the screens were huge. There was no way that they couldn't see what was, you know, the quiz. And it was really, really messed up. I didn't vote. Well, I voted a couple times. But it was just really awful. And people got really, really aggressive. And it degraded throughout the night about, what, you know, what people were saying up there. There was clearly someone had not thought this out very much, you know? So I'm walking around in the middle of the booze and the screens, and I'm looking at everybody, and I'm the only one that's there that's in costume that's not paid to be there. So I basically look like the help, and people are asking me to whip them because I have this bull whip, and I have to tell them, I'm like, look, no, you know, I'm just a guest. I just came with this guy that I met on the bus. Like, I don't know, but I, you know, and I'm not a skilled bull whip, you know, whip artist, so I just kind of, I played it down. So I ditch my date. I'm wandering around. People are asking me to bull whip them. And I see this one woman. There's a contortionist. And there's this other woman with this enormous snake, this sort of middle-aged woman. And it's a white python. And it's an albino python. And she looks exactly what you think a woman that would be hired to come to a party to hold, to present her albino python would look like. She's sort of middle-aged, you know, with the gypsy eye makeup that comes all the way out to black and lots of turquoise, flowy fabrics. And there's this big snake, and I love snakes. So I go up to her, I'm like, hey, can I hold the snake? You know, as much as I don't think, I love animals and I don't think they should be rented out and exploited like this, I was kind of drunk and I wanted to hold the snake. So I'm holding the snake and I'm talking to her about it. I'm like, where'd you get the snake? She goes, oh, my son bought it for me. It was my first snake, and now I have 10 of them, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm holding it. It's really heavy. It's about 8 feet long, and it's kind of curling up around me. So I give it back to her, and the snake kind of, like, is caught, and I look down, and the poinsettia pin that I was wearing was open, and the whole pin was had pierced the snake. It was all the way through down to the bottom of the pin. So I pull the snake off of me really quickly and just hand it back to her and say thanks and then, like, go downstairs. I wasn't really worried. I was still pretty drunk. I still had my bull whip. I don't think anyone saw me assault the snake. And after Mastercraft finished, I met back up with my date and we're talking and hanging out with his coworkers. I'm like, oh, you know, who did you want me to meet? And he goes, oh, my mom. I'm like, your mom? You wanted me to meet your mom already? He goes, oh, well, yeah, you know, she was working the party. She was the snake handler. She brought this big snake I bought for her a couple years ago. I'm like, the big white one? And he goes, yeah, I bought her that snake. I love that snake. But I think, I don't know why she had to go. She said she'd talk to me tomorrow and that I should have a good time. And I'm like, oh, I hope she's okay. He's like, yeah, oh, everything's fine. And I completely freaked out and had a quick drink and hightailed it out of there. So I hailed a cab and got in it and texted this guy that I met on the dance floor and had him meet me at this bar by my place, and we hung out all night and made out.
Hey, My name is Joshua Glenn. I'm a semiotic cultural analyst and an independent scholar and a journalist and an editor, and I have a couple of websites, one of which is called hilobrow.com, which is an intellectual website published with my friend Matthew Battles. Hilobrow started this year, and the most popular post we published in the year 2009 was by Matthew. It's called 13 Ways of Looking at Apollo. He published it on June 23rd, 2009. And it's about technology. It's really about the space race in the 60s and how all these things that seemed so futuristic back then, the idea of sort of being surrounded by technology, wearing technology, monitoring yourself all the time, being in constant communication across space with other people, all those things which seem like the future are now the present in a kind of sad and depressing way in some ways, and a cool ways in others. So it's sort of about the mythology of technology. One of the reasons this post was so popular was because it was picked up by Boing Boing and Io9, the Gawker science fiction blog, because what Matthew does so well is write about technology and history in a way that is very literary and poetic and beautiful. So it kind of has he's got a wide appeal to a lot of different types of people. And people, you know, it's such a symbolic issue, landing on the moon and the space race and all these kind of the lost glamour of that era back when we were just trying to explore the space with manned spacecraft, that, you know, it speaks to people in different ways. One of the interesting things that came out in the comments is how it got people thinking about space and what space once meant to us. The shuttle explosion, people feel the Challenger shuttle explosion, put an end to a lot of dreaming. Kind of felt like the end of an era, and if you were born in a generation that kind of came after that or who was just growing up when the Challenger blew up, you kind of missed out on a time when, you know, there seemed like endless frontiers and more excitement and more possibilities, and technology is going to be used for cool, interesting things that would help humankind and the planet and not just sort of help us have more gadgets. A guy named Rick posted saying, the accident and the dullness, in my humble opinion, of the shuttle program in general points to how far they overreach with the Apollo missions. The balls of those guys. I don't see the will to do anything like it, like a manned mission to Mars anytime soon. Nice try, W. But luckily that means we can be free to think of such a proposal as fantastic again, not the next logical step.
My name is Patty Johnson, and I write a blog called Archetype City, and the purpose of Archetype City is to introduce people to new and emerging art. And so as the editor, I spent a lot of time looking at art and then reporting on it. The most popular post on Archetype City this year was not written by me. It was part of the image management series that I run. That series was started because I was visiting a lot of studios and noticing that people were had just as much interesting material on their computers as source material as off. And so I felt like that needed a venue for exhibition. The Nine Eyes of Google Street View, which is an essay by John Rathman, was the most popular post this year. And, in fact, the most popular post that has ever appeared on a blog, ever. We published that post on August 12th, and a lot of people have written about Google Street View, but what I thought was so extraordinary about John Rathman's post was not just the amount of time he spent culling the material, which of course was no less than a year, and he had a Canada Council grant to do that, but I thought some of the more compelling images, there was an image that he had found of a man with a shotgun who looked like he had just come out of Walmart or something like that, you know, and he was just walking the streets. So it was one image of two hookers that sort of reminded me of a Jeff Wall picture, another image, like a broken image that had just taken when the Google Street View camera had, broken for, a period of time when it was shooting. And these, like, images looked like abstract art, you know. And, these sort of accidental moments of beauty that John found, you know, his intentionality, I think, was what really made this post so special. The amount of thought that he put into the, a lot of the ethical issues that come up with Google Street View, you know, there's no human eye behind it. So it catches things that sometimes are illegal, And he talked about this in the essay, because there's really only one way, you know, Google has a report this sort of function, but, you know, who knows what happens with that. The comment thread was filled mostly with individual comments. You know, a lot of the people that were commenting were not, you know, part of the RPEG City, like, regular readers. They were people who came in and, like, from, you know, all over the world, and, you know, this touched them in one particular way. And, in fact, I had a lot of friends send me images of themselves after that that essay was published, which I thought was a little bit strange, because they all came from the same geographical, like location. They were all friends of mine from Toronto who, like, coincidentally were sending me Google Street Views that they had found of themselves.
My name is Wayne Marshall. I wear lots of hats. I'm an ethnomusicologist, currently teaching at MIT. I'm a DJ. I'm a producer to some extent. I'm a proud father of two, and I'm also a blogger. I have a blog at wayneandwax.com. It appears that the most viewed post of mine, the most popular post I wrote this year, I published on January 30th, 2009, and I called it Demnar Rum, which is sort of Jamaican dancehall slang for they don't play around. And the whole post is sort of about a couple different copyright disputes that were happening in the dancehall world. A particular case had to do with a song by Bites Cartel, a duet with a singer named Spice. A song called Rampin' Shop, which is partly why I said Demna Romp, because, you know, the song is called The Rampin' Shop. He's, you know, says, come into my Rampin' Shop. It's a very racy song. The whole thing is you know, barely veiled innuendo, a sort of very sexy back and forth between them. And, you know, Romp, it means to play around, but also, you know, it's sort of a Jamaican pronunciation of romp, you know, and so they're romping in the bedroom, basically. But then there's also this secondary meaning of, you know, the international copyright, you know, conglomerates are not playing around with Jamaicans either. What sort of made this a story was that while a very popular hit in Jamaica, it wasn't until the song started getting regular airplay on Hot 97 in New York that it came to the attention of EMI, who, you know, controlled the copyright on the part of the artists in question, which were Neo and his producers, Stargate. Basically, Rampin' Shop, in sort of typical Jamaican rhythm method version, you know, versioning approach, used the complete instrumental from Neo's Miss Independent, which was a very popular song last year, and then Vibes, Cartel, and Spice record their own vocals on top of it, and it proved a very popular hit in Jamaica and in the reggae diaspora more generally. And so my post is sort of going through that and talking about it, and talking to some extent about the hypocrisy at the heart of the case, because there are lots of ways in which Neo and his producers themselves are sort of participating in this remix culture. And also I was just noting that, you know, the Vibes Cartel and Spice song was only one of really dozens of tracks that were recorded over that, which is, you know, fairly commonplace these days in kind of global remix culture, that a popular hip-hop and R&B song, which is already being sort of shoved in our ears, you know, wherever we might go, that these tracks then also tend to take on lives of their own as, you know, people take that very public culture and put their own spin on it. I think the post is popular mainly because the song is popular, you know, the Vibes Cartel and Spice's Rampin' Shop. And so I think as many people were simply searching for that song, and happened upon my post, I guess my post, you know, gained some Google juice over the weeks and months and over the year. And so, you know, I don't think it was simply people interested in the copyright dispute per se, but people who were even just interested in the, you know, the songs and materials at the heart of the case. There are about 30 comments, which is a good number for my blog. I'm definitely happy with the conversation that goes that long. I also ended up getting some very interesting sort of Norwegian nationalists commenting and saying that it wasn't really fair for me to pick on these the producers of the original, the Miss Independent song, are these two Norwegian hip-hop R&B producers who are based in New York. But I got some interesting comments in particular because my own blog was picked up by a Norwegian news source and linked to this linked to me. And so I got some readers from Norway who are basically saying, you know, this is theft. Why can't you acknowledge that their intellectual property has been violated? And referring to the Jamaican artists in question as half-assed.
My name is Tim Kreider, formerly the creator of the comic strip The Pain, When Will It End?, which ran in the Baltimore City Paper for 12 years. I wrapped it up and retired in the spring. So after I quit cartooning, I devoted myself more full-time to writing, and I got this cushy gig at the New York Times writing for their Happy Days blog, which is a blog about happiness. And I'm pretty sure that my most popular piece for them was on something I called The Referendum, which ran September 17th of this year. I don't know quantitatively that it was the most popular piece because their counter, which measures the most emailed pieces and which lots of New York Times writers watch obsessively, happened to be broken that day. So although there's no way of objectively measuring whether it was the most emailed or how many hits it got far and away more comments than any of my other pieces had. Also, people really seemed to respond to it. This is an essay that was actually inspired by an old friend of mine who's an editor asking me to write about something else. He wanted me to write a piece about arrested adolescence, which is really a piece he should have written himself, but he doesn't have time to write things because he's an editor. I think the piece he wanted had way more to do with his perception of what he thinks my life must be like than my own experience of what my life really is like. And to his consternation, it inspired me to write a much better essay for the New York Times instead, which is about this syndrome I call the referendum. I mean, after he asked me to write this piece saying, you know, needless to say, I thought of you, I was like, well, wait a minute, man, what do you mean, needless to say, you thought of me? And I wondered, does he regard me as you know, somehow stunted or more immature than he is just because, like, he's an editor and he's got a house and a family and, you know, I'm just some guy living in a turret with a cat. So I wrote this piece about the referendum, which I'll go ahead and read you a short paragraph from it. This is the paragraph that sort of defines what that syndrome is. The referendum is a phenomenon typical of, but not limited to, midlife, whereby people, increasingly aware of the finiteness of their time in the world, the limitations placed on them by their choices so far, and the narrowing options remaining to them, start judging their peers' differing choices with reactions ranging from envy to contempt. The referendum can subtly poison formerly close and uncomplicated relationships, creating tensions between the married and the single, the childless and parents, careerists and the stay-at-home. It's exacerbated by the far greater diversity of options available to us now than a few decades ago when everyone had to follow the same drill. We're all anxiously sizing up how everyone else's decisions have worked out to reassure ourselves that our own are vindicated, that we are, in some sense, winning. I'm sure you know from your own experience that the work you do that turns out to be the most popular and resonates with people usually resonates with people for reasons that have very little to do with why it was important to you. But it pleased me for various petty and spiteful reasons that it was so popular. I mean, I ended up writing a perfectly good piece for my friend who asked for the essay on arrested adolescence, though not, I think, as good as the one that it inadvertently inspired me to write. And he's a writer, too. I mean, he and I are old college friends. You know, we've driven across the country together. We've closed down innumerable bars. And, you know, we have very different lives now. It's the referendum. We all made our choices. I mean, he decided to get married, to have kids, to buy a house, to be a respectable taxpaying grown-up. So now he's got, you know, college funds and mortgage payments to worry about. So he has to edit the magazine in Baltimore. I elected to do nothing instead, to goof off, which gave me hundreds of thousands of hours of leisure time to write and write and write some pieces, which ended up in the New York Times. So I win, at least for now. Thank you.
spent Christmas 2009 in a motel room in the middle of nowhere. My French girlfriend Julie's visa is expiring, and before she heads home to France, she wants to see the Pacific Northwest. So we spend a few days visiting my aunt in Seattle, and then we rent a car and drive to the Olympic National Rainforest. On the internet, we find a motel room with a full kitchen and Wi-Fi in Forks, Washington, which is just 12 miles from the rainforest. Julie wants to make crepes for Christmas Eve dinner. When we check in, the clerk tells me that we are the only Christmas vampire hunters this year. I have no idea what he's talking about. Of course, we didn't buy enough alcohol, so I have to drive into town. The only thing open is the Shell gas station. The woman behind the counter reminds me of someone's grandma gone to seed. I almost feel bad that she has to work on Christmas Eve. I wish her a happy holiday, and she says, "You too." But there's something wrong with her mouth. I look closer and I realize that she's wearing Halloween vampire teeth. I stare incredulously at her, and she just says, "What? We all wear these now." When I get back to the motel, Julie is on Skype with her family, chatting away. Even though I've known Julie for most of 2009, I still can't speak any French. But I can tell, though, that she is making fun of me. And sure enough, she lifts up the laptop and points the camera at the trash, which is overflowing with beer bottles. This makes everybody laugh. Her brother keeps saying, "Rose collage." And I feel I have to defend myself and tell him that these are beer bottles, not rosé bottles. But I keep my mouth shut. In the morning, I let Julie sleep in, and I drive into town to get coffee. Sure enough, the man working behind the counter at the Shell station is wearing vampire teeth. On the way back, I notice there's a store open on Main Street, which is strange. It is Christmas morning and all. So I park the car and check it out. There are tons of people going in and out of this store. A giant sign in the window reads, "Get your official Forks Twilight gear here." Thanks to the iPhone and Wikipedia, I learned that Twilight is a story about vampires set in Forks, Washington, and that the books and the movies are the most popular thing in America for 2009. I can't figure out what makes me more upset, though. The fact that I've never even heard of Twilight, or the fact that the hotel clerk assumed that I had come here all the way from New York City for some pop culture pilgrimage. I drive back to the motel and park the car. Julie's awake and making more crepes, this time with lemon and sugar. She asks me to take her picture. "Why?" I ask. "So I can have remembrances of this time period of my life," she says. "Don't you want a picture?" No way, I think to myself. I am so glad that 2009 is almost over, because I totally failed at everything in 2009. I didn't keep a single vow I made that night in Madrid. Well, besides the heart thing. But considering I am now in the biggest jam of my life, I should have just worked on my 1984 documentary. But I don't say any of this to Julie. I just smile for the camera. And when she shows me the picture, I'm taken aback. I look sort of hopeful, like someone who thinks 2010 might turn out okay. This episode of Too Much Information was called 2009. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Val Dorito and help from Bill Bowen. You can find links to the most popular posts by Dan Sinker, Vanessa Bertozzi, Joshua Glenn, Patty Johnston, Wayne Marshall, and Tim Kreider, as well as a whole lot more information on the Too Much Information show page at WFMU.org. Happy New Year. See you in 2010.
Thank you.